You're listening to the Whale Scout Podcast with your host, Whitney Negebauer.
Welcome to the Whale Scout Podcast, everyone. My name is Whitney Negebauer, and I'm the director of Whale Scout. Today is September 24th, and today I am just about over the moon. We're going to have Alexandra Morton on the podcast in a little bit. She's an independent scientist, book author, and advocate for wild salmon in British Columbia. So, I just want to run through some quick upcoming events and news, and then we'll get straight to our interview today. October 4th, on Thursday night, Whale Scout is having a community pint night at Karen Brewing in Kenmore. We'll be doing a fun fundraiser, sending letters to the governor's task force, which, by the way, should be having their draft report out today. As of 2 o'clock, I have not seen it yet, but stay tuned for that. Public comment will be open till October 7th. On October 6th, Whale Scout will be teaming up with Friends North Creek Forest to do a habitat restoration event. So come help plant trees and then afterwards walk over to North Creek to hopefully look at spawning salmon there. October 14th is the CAF workshop, and CAF stands for Community Action Look Forward, which will be at the San Juan Island Grange Hall. And I'll be speaking there about some individual actions that people can do to help restore salmon for killer whales. One such example would be October 20th, where Whale Scout teams up with King County Parks to do another tree planting event down at the Moore Island Marine Park. And that's the largest undeveloped stretch of shoreline in King County. Really important spot for our forage fish and for juvenile Chinook salmon. If you are interested in becoming a Whale Scout volunteer naturalist, save the date for October 27th. We'll be doing a volunteer training at Seahurst Park down in Burien. And just right now, hot off the press from the Center for Whale Research, they are a little bit concerned about K-25 scoter. On September 18th, they had an encounter with him, and from their website, they're saying he's looking skinny and a little lethargic. He was non-cooperative and surfacing irregularly, so they let him go and did not get a really good look at him, but they are a little bit concerned about him. I believe tomorrow at the Whale Museum, John Durbin is giving a talk on some of the work that he's doing with aerial drones, looking at body condition. So perhaps John Durbin will have some additional information on K-25 and about the rest of our 74 southern resident killer whales and how everyone else is looking. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce our guest, Alexandra Morton. Welcome back to the Whale Scout Podcast. I'm joined now by Alexandra Morton, a independent scientist, author, and now advocate for wild salmon in BC. Alexandra, how are you today?
I'm really good and happy to be speaking to the whale people.
Yes, we are so delighted to be talking with you. I just have to let you know, I mean, your books have been influential in my life, and I know in the lives of a lot of our volunteers. And so it's really a privilege to be talking with you today. So thank you. I know that I want to go a little bit through a discussion about your career, beginning with killer whales and now leading into salmon. Early on, I understand that you did some work with John Lilly, an eccentric scientist known for unique experiments with dolphins studying communication and intelligence. Can you tell us a little bit about what that was like and how that shaped your future work?
Well, I was very young, probably 19 or so, and I, from an early age, was interested in trying to communicate or figure out the communication of some non-human on this planet. And so I wanted something with a large brain, and that basically meant the cetaceans, you know, the dolphins, or elephants, or the primates. And I chose dolphins, and was fascinated by Dr. Lilly's work, where he was convinced that dolphins were capable of higher thought, and was very curious as to how to, you know, interface with them. So He actually invited me up to his place to paint a mural. I'm also an artist. And while I was painting this mural in his hallway, there was a door at the end of the hall that was open one day, and all this cool air was coming out. And being Southern California, I went to close it, and it was this wall-to-wall audio tape. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is all the recordings of all the research he's done on dolphins to this date. And so that evening, I asked him if I could listen to them, and he was really gruff. He was like, no. And he must have seen my face fall, and he said, but we need somebody to catalog the tapes. And I said, okay, I'll do that. Can I listen to them while I'm cataloging? So we struck a deal, and it was volunteer work. And I found very quickly that I really was not interested in the recordings of him trying to teach dolphins a language. What really grabbed me was the dolphins talking to each other. And I kept thinking, these are two large brains communicating. I'm a large brain. I should be able to tap into this and at some point figure out what they're talking about. And so I spent 2 years doing this work. It was as a volunteer. But then, you know, I really wanted to meet some live dolphins. I wanted to get out of the audio world. Although I have to say it's a good way to meet dolphins. If all you can do is hear them, you are immersed in the part of the world that is most important to them. And so, from there I went to do research on dolphins in captivity, which, you know, wasn't always a great experience. And the pair of killer whales there gave birth while I was studying the dolphins. And the curator from Marineland of the Pacific asked if I would come and record the whales. And as soon as I dropped a hydrophone into their tank and heard their calls, it just clicked. I was like, okay, I have found the animal I want to spend the rest of my life with. Their sounds were right in my hearing range. I found them infinitely beautiful and interesting. They were very polite vocalizers as opposed to the dolphins, which just were crazy, you know, all talking at once. And that's where I really got hooked on the orca and trying to figure out what they were saying.
So you mentioned that it was not always great. If you had it to do over again, would you have skipped out on studying killer whales and dolphins in captivity?
Oh, yes. Yeah. The images and experiences were traumatic to me, and I can only imagine that's a fraction of what the whales were feeling. So the female, the whales were called Orky, the male, and Corky, the female. And she lost all her babies. I was there for 4 or 5 births, and she just simply did not know how to nurse them. Mm-hmm. However, she was deeply attached to them, and she would have done anything to protect and to feed and to nurture those babies. But they starved to death, even as she was swimming and milk was coming out, flowing into the tank. She needed another whale to push the baby down so that it would learn to nurse in the right spot. Because what happened was it was a round tank, and so she was constantly nosing the baby in a circle so that it wouldn't ram into the wall. And they all did. They all ended up with huge dents on their jaw because they were hitting the wall. So she's nosing them to one side. And it seems to me that young orca have some kind of innate understanding that they need to go to a white patch, and the babies would become fixated on her eye patch and would try to nurse on the side of her mouth, which all kind of fits, white patch, you know, it's got the right form, and they would curl their tongues and desperately try to nurse on their mouth. And it was horrifying. And you know, the people in charge of her health, the curators and the trainers, they were caught in this too and did everything they could. They trained her on a model. They got in there eventually and took babies out. They tried to put the baby on her in the right place. but it just didn't work. She needed another female orca. And so after a few years of that hell, I realized that, you know, studying communication in these two poor animals or whales would be like studying somebody who was insane in a prison. And you're unlikely to get a real grip on their language. So I then went to British Columbia and I actually found her family, the A5s. But to this day, I feel extremely guilty that, you know, I went and found her family and she's still in the tank.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a really powerful story that you shared. What was it like hearing her family in the acoustics from her family for the first time?
Oh, wow. Well, first of all, there was no sound of the drain, and the calls just filled Johnson Straits. They carried on and they echoed multiple times, and you could hear whales in the distance. And then, you know, the really gut-wrenching thing was to see the fat and sassy babies that were, you know, wrestling over top of their moms and just being little orca. So, yeah, I took one sniff of British Columbia and I was like, okay, this is my habitat. I'm going to get off the bus here and just stay. And I did. But, yeah, so, you know, people do argue that whales in captivity are educational. And no doubt that's true. But the big lesson is that they don't belong there. Because family to orca means more than anything. I mean, imagine being a mammal in the ocean. You cannot build a cave or a nest or a fort, or you can never lie down. You are the only home you have is to be enveloped by your family. And I think, you know, in watching them, it's a fair assessment, particularly what we saw this summer. That orca would rather die than be separated from their families. And, you know, I've seen adult males lose their mothers, and these are males that are in their 30s, and they just circled for weeks. The bonds are something that even we perhaps can't understand. They're so close.
Yeah, I was going to ask you if you had been following the story of J35 this summer, and what was your interpretation of her carrying her dead calf on her nose for so long?
Well, you have to see it as a mother's love for her baby. I don't think it's fair to assess that in any other way. You know, we're supposed to, and maybe this is wearing off, but scientists are supposed to not impose our feelings, not anthropomorphize, you know, what we're seeing. But on the other hand, if you're seeing it, you can't deny it. And orca, you know, who knows really what's going on there in their minds? Because I think it's fair to say that most people that have worked closely with orca have had somewhat mind-bending experiences with them, where you just don't know what to think. And this whale, you know, what she did brought a message like no one or nothing could ever do. And so I don't know, you know, I don't know why she did this, but I do know that it affected millions of people. And my hope is that it moves us towards something real, where we don't just mourn over things, but we actually get up and do something.
Yeah. And what about the story and then the human response effort that was initiated over J50, the ailing and thin 3.5-year-old whale? And there was discussions about capturing her and bringing her in for a health assessment and rescue. Humans did intervene and administer antibiotics. What's your response to all that?
I don't know what's right and wrong there. I think that if I had been watching her, I would have been tempted to hope for her capture. I was part of the return of Springer, the little orca from the northern residence that somehow ended up attached to a ferry down your way. And it worked. so with Scarlett, you know, there would have been her family to return to, and I suspect they would have accepted her back. I'm certain of it, but it probably would have killed her. So at that point, at that point, I don't know that there's a right or wrong. The outpouring of human grief and concern did force action. And what I'd like to see is that energy now move towards keeping the rest of the family alive and really drill down on what is going on with Chinook salmon, and then just take action and fix this problem. Because it's not just good for the orca, it's good for everything. If you save salmon, it turns out you save a heck of a lot. And I hope we can transpose that emotion and not forget about it, but move forward and actually make some changes.
And that's really been the trajectory of your work and your career. You are now focused on salmon. Can you tell us how that shift happened and, you know, bring us up to present day, if you could, of what's going on now with Atlantic salmon farming in BC?
Sure. So in 1984, I went to look for the perfect place to study resident whales, northern residents, particularly the A5, for the rest of my life. And I found a community called Echo Bay in the Broughton Archipelago, actually followed whales in there, and it was perfect. So I lived on a boat at the time and began just following the whales, learning an enormous amount about them in the winter and about their social behavior. It was the perfect place to study their sounds because they would break down into their basically smallest divisible unit, which is mom and the kids. So it was easy for me to keep track of everybody in the correlational study I was doing between what they were saying, what they were doing. And there was a small community of about 200 people all living in float houses. And when the salmon farming industry first came in 1989, I thought, oh, wow, good idea. There'll be more jobs. We had a little one-room school. I had a four-year-old, you know. So they were saying it was going to be good for us, that it was going to take pressure off the wild salmon. And I actually offered to talk to women who might want to come out there and be in the industry just to let them know what a great place it was to raise your children. And then the fishermen started to talk to me first. And I spend a lot of time talking to fishermen because they're salmon predators that basically speak English, unlike the orca, which are, I had to definitely learn their language. But the orca, you know, they're also salmon predator. But I have a lot more trouble communicating with them. And I learned so much from fishermen. You know, for example, why does the male orca go up Kinkam Inlet in the spring with 6 inches of their dorsal fin showing for hours? And they're like, oh, I know. That's because the glacial meltwater is about 5 feet deep, and that's where the big Chinook salmon are sitting. And so, oh, yeah, that made perfect sense.
Yeah.
So these guys came to me, and they said, look, could you write to the Federal Fisheries Department and let them know they're putting these farms in all the wrong places? And I said, oh, what do you mean? And they said, well, they're putting them in our hot spots where the salmon are schooling, where the rock cod are most abundant, and where the prawns are. And I said, oh, sure, yeah, that must be a mistake. And so thinking back to myself then, I have to feel a little bit sorry for that woman, and really, she should have gotten up and left and gone north if you wanted to, you know, really figure out what killer whales were saying, because that was a real Y in the road for me. I was ready for this, too. I read every book about people that go into the wilderness to study animals, and their books are always in three parts. Part one is wow. Part two is, oh, no, it's all about to come apart due to some human activity. And part three is grad students and talking to politicians and fighting desperately and usually unsuccessfully to stop whatever it is going terribly wrong. So I was ready. I was not going to get past part one. I ignored logging. I ignored whales in captivity. And when these guys came to me and asked me to write a letter, I didn't realize that, you know, what a big decision that was. But I did write the letter, and then I wrote 10,000 pages of letters. I had little hatch marks above my little printer and my float house. I'd fire up my generator. I would, you know, print out many copies of these letters because I knew it was no good to just send it to one person. This was before the internet. And the postmistress said I kept the post office open for a period of time because it came once a week by seaplane. And the response from government was always the same. It was, "Dear Ms. Morton, there is no evidence of whatever I was talking about, whatever I had seen about these farms, whether it was the toxic algae blooms or Atlantics in the river or gunfire or displacement of the whales due to the seal scares." And finally, 10,000 pages later, I realized that they were saying there's no evidence. They weren't saying you're wrong.
Right.
I also realized they were not out there. I was out there. They were not. And so I thought, okay, I am the biologist on scene. I should just start collecting the data on these issues that I'm seeing. And then I'm sure that they will see that there's a problem and we will figure out how to deal with this. And so in the mid-90s, I wrote a paper on the displacement of the resident orca from the Broughton Archipelago due to these acoustic harassment devices that the farms were playing to keep seals away. And they were at 198 decibels, which is as loud as a jet engine at takeoff. And they were designed to actually cause pain in the ears of the seals to keep them away from the fish, which I guess was better than shooting them. But the problem is the orca, you know, have the same hearing range as the seals. And so what damaged the seals was probably damaging the orca. And it's unbelievable. I watched every subgroup come in and never come back.
Wow.
Which, because for them, it was basically like walking into a room with needles coming at our eyeballs. You know, they are not going to risk their primary sense. That's clear. Then it's a lesson for everybody. You know, orcas have their limits as to what they can take from us. And as the years went by, I was thinking, I know I loved my town by then, and my kid was in school, and I was very much at home. I was good at living out there. It's off-grid, you know, no ferries. It was fabulous life. But I kept thinking, oh, man, if I'm really a whale researcher, I should go where there's whales. But then, you know, I don't know whether it's because I was comfortable, but I also had this nagging thought, somebody has to record the disappearances. Somebody has to stand ground. And so I published a paper on the displacement of the orca, which is against the law in Canada, to even make them deviate from their path, never mind, you know, displace them from a huge area. And then the sea lice epidemic started, and I wrote about 20 scientific papers on that. I turned my home into a research station, which was crawling with brilliant grad students. I was trying to talk to politicians. I went to Norway, spoke at the AGMs. Then I began leading, you know, activism. I walked to the whole Vancouver Island. 5,000 people joined me at the end. Made no difference to the government. I paddled with 100 people down the lower Fraser River. Made a little progress with that one, but not much. And now I study viruses, in particularly this salmon blood virus called piscine reovirus, which is infecting 80% of the farm salmon. That's what the industry says. So it could be even more. And recently it was discovered that this virus infects the red blood cells of Chinook salmon and causes the cells to explode. It's highly contagious. It's highly durable, which means it drifts a long distance in the current. And there are salmon farms on every wild salmon migration route in southern British Columbia. So back to J50 and the plight of the southern resident whales in general, my very strong sense is if we want Chinook salmon on this coast, we better turn off the virus tap. The evidence suggests that this virus is from Norway. Now, Washington State did an amazing thing. First of all, they passed a law to phase Atlantic salmon farming in the ocean out. So that was fabulous. Those farms are going to shut down. It's going to take till 2022, but they're on their way out. But then earlier this year, the Washington State government prohibited 800,000 Atlantic salmon infected with this virus from going into a farm in Puget Sound. And for us up here in British Columbia, this was huge. We thought, wow, yes, this is really taking action. That's a very effective thing to do. Just stop putting diseased fish into the water. But I have been in court with the federal Canadian Minister of Fisheries to stop him from doing the same thing, even though it is against the law to put fish infected with a diseased agent into the waters of Canada. I won the lawsuit in 2015, and he is simply ignoring it, ignoring the court decision. So I had to go back to court, and that hearing was a week ago. So fighting this industry has just absorbed my entire life. And but I can't let go now because I know all about it, and I know the impact it's having. And so I keep going and try to be creative and diligent with my attempts to get it out of the water.
And how have the Atlantic salmon farms impacted Fraser River returns? So that's something in the U.S. where we're really concerned about, because the Fraser River is a major source of food for southern resident killer whales. What's going on in the Fraser, and how much of an influence have these farms had on the Chinook salmon there?
Okay, so the basic research for that has not been done. So we don't have any definitive answers. But here's the situation. The majority of salmon that leave the Fraser River turn right when they enter the ocean, and they go up north between Vancouver Island and the mainland. And there, they run into about 75 Atlantic salmon farms, particularly in small, narrow waterways, like all through the Discovery Islands, off of Campbell River. And it's these small, narrow passages when there's a farm in it, and it's producing 65 billion infectious virus particles per hour, which is a government number. Wow. What happens is it's like running sheep through sheep dip. You know, every single fish is exposed. The way fish breathe is they take water in, they pass it over their gills, and then the bloodstream comes and tries to pick up oxygen from the water. Well, for a virus that infects red blood cells, this is just a dream come true. They're pouring out of the farms, and here come these little wild fish, and they're breathing them in and passing them right over their bloodstream. I've done quite a bit of research on the sea lice infestations that happen around fish farms, because sea lice are a pathogen you can actually see, and they're very easy to work with because they change their body shape every few days for the first month. So you can see exactly where fish are getting infected. And all species of salmon that are coming out of the Fraser River and are passing these farms off Campbell River are being exposed and infected with sea lice. And then last December, I published a paper on where on the coast are wild fish infected with this piscine reel virus. And we found that close to 40% of the wild fish passing through the Discovery Islands become infected with this virus that clearly can be traced to Norway. Whereas if you go to the most northern reaches of British Columbia, where there are no farms, it's less than 5% of the fish that are infected.
Wow.
Now, you might wonder, how are they infected at all? Well, of course, fish move and they mingle and collide with other populations. So here you have 40% of wild salmon are infected with a virus that's causing their red blood cells to explode. I mean, really, we do need to do more work to prove all of that. But if having whales and wild salmon is your goal, the thing to do is look at the situation. The wild salmon are not going to move. They can't move. The salmon farming industry can. It can go into tanks. And the industry is moving that way naturally in some countries like Norway because they can't handle their own disease problems. Their sea lice are becoming drug resistant. Their pathogens are becoming more virulent. So just pop them into a tank and you can control all of that.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's what needs to happen. Just the government should, if they really want this industry, they should give them incentives and just get them into a tank.
Yeah.
Done. Let's keep our wild fish and our whales.
It took in Washington State a complete disaster, the collapse of a net pen farm and the escape of like hundreds of thousands of Atlantic salmon into Puget Sound to, in order to get them out. And I wish that that had never happened, although it was sort of a blessing in disguise where we've gotten them phased out. Is there anything that people in the U.S. and Washington State can do to help your efforts in B.C.?
Don't eat farm salmon, number one. I mean, I wouldn't eat it anyway, but don't eat it till it comes from a tank. Number two, if you wouldn't mind writing to the Premier of British Columbia, Premier John Horgan, and just Google it. You can get his email address, premier@gov.bc.ca. Write to him and say, look, we have done what is necessary, but all of our fish are still going through British Columbia. You know, we've had head tags recovered in Chinook salmon from the Elwha River up in the Broughton Archipelago where I am. And furthermore, there's been an incredible Indigenous uprising about this industry. There's several tribes in the Broughton where I live who have decided that the collapse of fish in their area is probably due to the salmon farms. There's no other evidence of what it could be. They've cut back fishing. The fish are collapsing in virgin watersheds that are unlogged as well as logged watersheds. And there's all kinds of indicators that disease and sea lice and salmon farms are the problem. And members of these communities spent 280 days occupying salmon farm sites last winter. I was out there with them because, you know, I had to show support for this incredible action. As a result, our government, BC government, has entered into talks with these nations. And last June, they promised that they would tell us what's going to happen in 90 days. Well, 90 days are up on Thursday, on the 27th of September. And so I don't really have my hopes up, but it would be amazing if we could just start the process of moving the industry into tanks, you know, run with that, develop that industry. There's lots of businessmen that are into it. Clearly, it's an idea that works. And then there's this amazing scientist here who can read the immune system of salmon. It's a woman scientist in the government. Her name is Dr. Christy Miller. And because she can read the immune system of salmon, we could ask salmon all along their migration routes, how are you guys doing? And the salmon can answer us and say, you know, I've got low oxygen problems, or I'm starving, or I've got a problem with copper, or it's sea lice are eating me, or I've got a virus in my heart. Now, I've got a virus in my muscle. I have a virus in my lungs. The information in the immune system of these fish is so detailed. It's like going back to the time of the legends where salmon were talking to people. They can do this. And so then we can go in and go, oh, you've got a problem with copper? Let's see. Oh, maybe it's this pipe here. Let's do this, that, and the next thing. And then the next year we can go back to the salmon and we can say, did we make it better for you? And the salmon can say yes or no,
wow,
or a little bit or a lot. And this to me is so exciting because as a species, we really need to learn to dovetail into the natural systems. We need to see where the power cords are in our natural world. And we have to make sure those power cords are facilitated. They are allowed to exist. Instead of being like crazy men on lawnmowers and just like running everything over, cutting it all up, and then wondering why the power's gone off in our house, we can see these things. And between science and, you know, our social awareness, I think that, and our love, I mean, it really is, all of this is an act of love, and these whales allow that love to grow in a way that can actually save us, because, of course, we're part of this world. So, you know, that's the vision I have for turning this coast back on, and the economy, and the whales, and, you know, it seems like a really good idea to me.
Yeah, it's like letting nature be nature again, and giving the power back. It's been such a pleasure talking with you. Is there anything else that you would like our listeners to know?
You can follow me on Facebook. There's quite an active dialogue there. So just Alexandra Morton. And make sure that Washington State doesn't backslide on this whole decision.
Absolutely.
Make sure that they actually get the farms out.
Yes, and hopefully sooner than projected. Yeah.
Yes, I went and saw the site where the big escape was, and I talked to a woman who lives there, and she kayaks every day, and she really made me cry. She said, since that farm's gone, we have crabs back on the beach, we have sea cucumbers, we have loons, the herring were all over the place. I don't think we have any idea of how bad these farms are and the kind of impact, but to see everything bounce back so quickly, I thought, oh my gosh, please let that be here. Please let that be here.
Yeah. Wow. That is amazing. And I hadn't heard that. So thank you for sharing. That's wonderful. Thank you so much for coming on the Whale Scout podcast today. I'll put links up for a lot of the things that we talked about, including a Facebook page to follow you. And I wish you all the luck. Please don't hesitate to reach out and ask for our support again. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you so much. Great to talk to you.
Thanks again for listening, everyone. If you would like more information about Alexandra Morton and some of the work she's doing, head over to whalescout.org and look up this podcast, and we'll have links to some of the things that she was mentioning. Also, if you like this podcast, be sure to go to iTunes and hit subscribe, and you can get these podcasts sent directly to your phone so you can listen anywhere you go. Thanks so much for listening. Namaste.
Thank you for listening to the Whale Scout podcast. Your voluntary donation goes toward the recovery of whale species and enhanced whale watching opportunities in the Pacific Northwest. Please visit www.whalescout.org for more information. Trop bien démodé, aussi mal coiffé que rasé, j'entretiens ma gueule négligée.